This is the current federal tax developments for the week of December the 19th, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE and your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at a number of developments here in our pre-holiday edition of current federal tax developments. We'll talk about the Supreme Court's decision not to hear the case involving the Colorado use tax reporting issue. We have a couple that was found to have willfully violated the FBAR reporting requirements. We have another individual that got stuck with having to pick up interest on the purchase of land as being capitalized into the almond trees that were being grown. The IRS has released the 2017 mileage rates. We have a discussion of the grading and compaction work and how on residential lots that managed to, in the view of the IRS, qualify a taxpayer to take completed contract method. We have an issue of a loss of exempt status for an organization when they failed to conduct activities for 11 years. And we have the IRS's reminder that due dates for information returns are going to be changing in the coming years so that we have some things that are going to be due on January 31st here. I want to talk to you about some of the things coming up here now in the State Society CPE. And we are getting toward the end of the period. A lot of state societies now, you know, we've gotten to basically finishing up the December CPE. And there's some in January, but in many cases, not a whole lot. But we still do have a few things going on. A lot of the state societies participate with Cal CPA and are involved in their webcast broadcast. So you can find these listed on many of your state society sites. And I wanted to point you out to a pair coming up in January from our sister organization, which is Los Calzo and Associates. On January the 18th, there will be a session on FASB and AICPA updates here for accounting and auditing, practical guidance put on by Ken Heeslip. That one also Ken's going to put on a week later, the Tax Practitioner's Guide to Accounting and Reporting Issues. Most of you can go to your state society website and you'll find a link on there on the webcast section to an option to get the Cal CPA programs. The advantage of going through your state societies are twofold. Number one, we'll be honest, your state society gets credit for that, which is useful. And they're able to basically, get something for having transferred this over to the Cal CPA site. But the second thing that helps there is you tend to qualify as a member discount by going that direction. So if you're available and you're looking for those dates and you need some ANA updates, they have it on both days. Both of these are rebroadcasts. What that means is that Ken will be available by basically through the chat box to answer your questions during each of these. Also, the other nice thing it means if you're not located on the West Coast is that there's going to be two different broadcasts that day, one of which will start 2 hours before the other. So one broadcast starts at 6:30 a.m. Pacific time or 9:30 a.m. Eastern time, and the other one starts 2 hours later at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time, 11:30 a.m. Eastern time. You can actually sign up for either one of those in most cases and decide which one of two you're going to take. But be sure to check your state society websites. A number of state societies, have these links. Just this morning, I was able to confirm that you can find information and the information to link to these sites on at least, the societies I looked at quickly this morning, including I knew Arizona had this one because Arizona's done this for a long time. Idaho has this directly, and you can directly do it on their website, link from there. We also found links to it on Oklahoma and New Mexico, ways to get in to do that. And effectively, a whole bunch of the state societies around the country have those links. So be sure to take a look for those links and consider if you need some ANA work, some ANA updates, which a lot of us do. We have some issues that we have to worry about what's going on with accounting. And so, pick up either the FASB update or pick up the Tax Practitioner's Guide to Accounting Issues coming up in January. Now let's start talking about our developments going forward. Well, the Supreme Court decided not to hear the appeal of the case of the Direct Marketing Association versus Brohl. That's the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, case number 12-1175. That case was decided back in February of this year, and the Supreme Court decided to deny the request to hear the case on December the 12th of this year. Now, for those of you who don't remember this case, this is the one that says, essentially, if you sell at least $100,000 worth of product into the state of Colorado, you sell $100,000 worth of products to Colorado residents, and you either sold $100,000 to residents last year, or you expect to sell $100,000 this year, then whenever you sell to a Colorado resident, you have to inform that resident of the fact they have use tax reporting obligations. If they buy more than $500 from you, you have to send them a summary of their purchases at the end of the year to let them know exactly how much they should be paying use tax on for purchases from you. And number three, and probably the biggest problem, is that you have to provide a report to the state of Colorado on the Colorado residents that bought from you, how much they bought, et cetera, so Colorado can go find these people in case they don't file their use tax reports. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals back in February ruled that this did not violate any constitutional prohibitions. Specifically, they ruled that it does not run into conflict with the Supreme Court's decision in the Quill case, so that it's perfectly okay for Colorado to ask for this type of reporting. Now that the Supreme Court denied the request for certiorari in the case, the Multi-State Tax Commission, now as reported by tax analysts this week, has actually restarted their project to get a standard reporting bill put together, which could be adopted by the various states. So don't be surprised if we see a lot of cases come down or a lot of situations and states try to adopt things like this. This is part of a number of challenges where states are trying to get expanded collection of their sales and use tax. That's something that you can expect to continue on, shall we say, for the near future. For the moment, what this really means is we have absolutely, there's no question that this is the law in the 10th Circuit. The Supreme Court's decision not to hear the case does not necessarily mean that this will be the law elsewhere in the country. The Supreme Court may simply be waiting for a contrary decision before they'd rule in the case, but it does mean that anywhere in the country, if you decide not to follow up, if Colorado decides to question you, or if you're selling into Colorado significant amounts and you're not fulfilling your obligations under this law, you do have a bit of a risk that you're taking from this point forward. So be aware of that. Next up, we have a case here involving a taxpayer who failed to report their foreign bank accounts on the FBAR reporting form. This is the case of the United States versus August Bowenek. This is from the United States District Court for the Central District of California, case number 2:15-CV-04347. The decision came down on December the 8th. Now, this particular taxpayer had operated a successful store in Pasadena, California. And he and his wife, though, had established some bank accounts in other countries. Now, it was driven by various issues, including the fact that they ended up having to deal with a Canadian distributor for the cameras they were selling because they ran into complaints from other vendors or other retailers in the U.S. that they were unfairly competing with them, and they restricted their ability to get these parts and items from the sole U.S. distributor. So they signed up with a Canadian distributor. All well and good, but they started putting their commissions and other payments from the Canadian distributor into this account in Switzerland. They did so based on the advice of somebody associated with the Canadian distributor. They also, over time, ended up setting up accounts in Austria and Mexico. Now, eventually, as you may become aware, we kind of became aware that UBS, who they established an account with in Switzerland, was going to be reporting taxpayers to the IRS. So these guys decided to go into the voluntary reporting system. However, there are a couple of problems they had with it. Number one, they only volunteered the UBS account. They withheld the Austrian and the Mexico account from the list. They also stated that all the funds in the account that was in the UBS account had come from after-tax dollars when, in fact, they were paying commissions into that account. They also failed to report certain payments and amounts they'd received from an eBay store they had set up. They essentially had that put into a foreign account, hadn't reported the income, and also, of course, didn't come clean about that. Well, they were kicked out of the voluntary program. The IRS went after them then for the full $100,000 or one half of the value in the account penalty for willful violation of your requirements to file your FBAR report. And the court in California agreed with the IRS that this amounted to willful violation. One of the more important things the court found, and they agreed now with a Fourth Circuit holding from a few years ago, was that in order to have willful failure to file, you didn't need to meet the criminal standard for willful fail. That is, knowing about a law and deciding not to follow it. Being reckless disregard for whether there were requirements under the law was found to be sufficient by the court to qualify for willful failure. In this case, the court found that the taxpayers were relatively sophisticated, had operated businesses for a number of years, and had taken steps to make sure nobody else knew about these accounts except their very close, their very close relatives knew about these accounts in Switzerland, but nobody else had them. They didn't volunteer them. They never told a CPA or an attorney or anybody else about these accounts. The court found that amounted to remaining willfully ignorant of your filing requirement. The court also spent some time, as did the one in the Fourth Circuit, pointing out that when they filled in their 1040 on the bottom of Schedule B were those questions regarding whether you had an offshore bank account. Again, the court used that as partial evidence when they answered those questions, no, that they had willfully failed to report the information in question. So we have some issues here. Certainly, this is another case where it looks like willfulness is going to be a lot easier for the service to establish in these areas than you might have thought. The attorney who represented the taxpayers in this case announced in Tax Analysts this week, as reported by Tax Analysts, that they are going to appeal this case to the Ninth Circuit. So this may not be the last we've heard of this one. We'll see if the Ninth Circuit agrees with how the court dealt with this, assuming that we actually get to trial on that case. So a couple of other issues coming up. We have another issue here. Wasco Rio Properties number one et al., it's a whole series of partnerships here, versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-224, issued on December the 13th, 2016. Now, this is actually a case dealing with the uniform capitalization rules, believe it or not. In this case, the taxpayer had purchased some land that it was going to be using, for farming in Central California. The partnerships in this case primarily grew almonds. So they were going to take what was currently crops that, were planted each year, and they were going to convert this over to an almond grove. So they bought the land, they bought it, got notes for the land, and they began to pay interest on those notes. Now they reported that interest expense as a deduction each year. But the IRS said, no, that represents pre-production costs of the almond grove, which represents real property. And as such, that has to be capitalized as part of the real property. The taxpayer said, no. That only applies to the land. And, we're creating trees, so the interest doesn't apply to the trees. The tax court didn't buy that line. What the tax court ruled was that the trees and the land were linked together. You could not put the trees into service without putting the land into service. And so the trees and land constituted a single piece of real property. As such, the interest on the land had to be capitalized during the pre-productive period of the trees, because you can't just go out and plant almond trees and, 2 days later start harvesting almonds. You're going to have them grow, get to maturity, and then start producing. So they had to capitalize and hold it. The court pointed out that already in other cases, when we talked about real estate developers who were building buildings on land, that they had to capitalize that interest related to the land into the buildings. The court found that this was the same situation, that the almond trees were in some respects like the buildings. You can't really build a building without having some land to put it on. You can't really grow an almond tree without having some land to grow your trees on. So they said those were linked and you had to do capitalization of that expense. Obviously, this is expensive for the taxpayer because all the interest they're paying, and of course it wasn't inexpensive to buy this land, is end up being non-deductible and being greatly deferred as to when they're going to get a deduction for those, for that particular interest. Well, the IRS this week in Notice 2016-79 on the 13th of December issued the standard auto mileage rates for 2017. And the standard business mileage rate dropped a half a cent. So it'll go down to 53.4 cents per mile, down from 54 cents per mile in 2016. So that's effective beginning January 1st. as well. The charitable mileage rate is going to be 14%, 14 cents. That is unchanged as normal. And the mileage rate for medical care will be 17 cents per mile. That's going to drop medical care and for moving. That's going to drop 2 cents per mile from the 2016 numbers. Now, the portion of the standard mileage rate treated as depreciation for automobiles used in business will be 25 cents in 2017. That's added to, you know, we have a different rate for each one. And this notice will give you the rates all the way back to 2013. For your amounts considered depreciation, if you're using the standard mileage rate, you still have to go back and consider there to be depreciation on the car equal to this rate per mile for what you've used for business purposes on the car. And for purposes of computing the allowance under a fixed and variable rate allowance, the standard cost, standard mobile cost 2017 may not exceed $27,900 for automobiles or $31,300 for trucks and vans. The IRS also reminded us that the standard business mileage rate cannot be used for a vehicle if you previously claimed accelerated depreciation or Section 179 expensing for a vehicle, nor can you use it for more than four vehicles. Next up, the IRS, in a technical advice memorandum, ruled that a contractor who had entered into a contract to grade and do soil compaction related to residential lots was considered a home builder eligible to use the completed contract method of accounting. Obviously, as a TAM, we had an agent who was disputing whether this contractor had eligible home building contracts that could get out of the percentage of completion method of accounting. The national office said, well, okay, we kind of understand, because apparently the agent was a little concerned about the results back in the Howard Hughes case. Remember that case from a couple of years ago in the Hughes court, Howard Hughes LLC versus commissioner, which was a Fifth Circuit case. They were denied the right to be treated as a home builder when they did this sort of work on land, but they did it related to common areas. The court said the IRS national office said this is different because here they're actually working on the home building lots. And as long as they do that, we should be fine. Now, the court did come down and tell us that while this sort of grading and soil compaction to get ready to put the foundation down for a home was part of the home building, they said not all of that sort of work would qualify. For instance, if a contractor had been called in to do just rough grading of a lot or to clear trees, that would simply be an improvement to the land that is non-depreciable. That is, assuming we're going to be able to depreciate the building that was created. And because of that, it would not qualify as home construction contracting. So we know we can get it in some cases, but this memorandum would suggest that you're going to have to go and look in some detail about the exact nature of a contract that a contractor who does this sort of work does to determine if that particular contract is a home building contract or if you're going to have to use the percentage of completion method of accounting on the contract. Turns out doing nothing can be very costly. This is the case of Community Education Foundation versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-223. The decision was issued on December 12th. Now, this foundation had applied for and received tax-exempt status back in 2001. It was going to be a conservative research and educational institute focusing on public policy issues that have particular impact on African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans, and heritage groups. And in order to fulfill its purpose, they actually had, and this was going to be 25% of their time would be spent, you know, conducting town hall meetings. They would end up doing just over half of their time would be workshops they would conduct for these groups. They would also have 10% of their time would be congressional forums that they would sponsor where they could have those. And they would spend the additional 10% on media and communication outreach issues to fulfill that exempt purpose. The IRS granted the exemption, all well and good. But then it turns out none of that ever happened. And the organization admitted that effectively, well, yeah, we really didn't do anything for quite a few years. But, you know, essentially, in about 2008, we actually tried to do some things. We actually tried to put together some activities of the group we had there. We tried to put these together. We tried to do a presidential inaugurational ball to honor veterans in 2009. We also tried to do some town hall meetings and benefit concerts oriented toward veterans. Catch was, none of those ever came off. The tax court said, look, to be an exempt organization, you have to be an organization that is conducting primarily exempt activities. But primarily exempt activities means you have to actually conduct exempt activities. The tax court agreed with the IRS that the fact you hadn't done anything, let's say, you know, as they said, that theory about try, we don't even care about try. You never did anything. Now, I guess you kind of, for those old Star Wars fans, you know, don't try do, that old thing from Yoda. I guess that's kind of what the tax court is saying here. Don't try do. Basically, you didn't do anything. Because you didn't do anything, the IRS was perfectly correct in taking away your exempt status because, you know, essentially, and this was a C3 organization, there seems little reason why anybody should get a tax deduction for contributing to an organization that effectively has never done anything and apparently isn't likely to do anything in the near future if we look at their past history of the 11 years. Finally, wanted to remind you of this because tax analysts noted this week, it reminded me to mention it. The IRS actually published this on their website at the end of October, but it's important to remember this. The due dates for a number of information returns are going to be changed this year. You can find this on the IRS website. It's titled Increase Information Return Penalties that you can find on their website. The link is in our materials that you can find on currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com site. Remember, W-2s and any 1099 miscellaneouses that have non-employee compensation, they need to be, the government versions of those forms need to be in by January 31st. The IRS has also fairly clearly indicated they are unlikely to grant extensions on the W-2. So effectively, the idea is we want them in early. This is to catch refund fraud or to catch earned income credit fraud. The IRS also reminded you that the penalties for late filing or sending the forms late to recipients have both gone up. So you should be aware, and the information and details on that are in tables in our materials that you'll find on currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com website. You go there, you go to our weekly updates, and you'll find it with this particular update for this week here on December the 19th. You'll find the link to these materials. You can download them, find them there. You want to make sure all your clients are aware of these the fact that we need to get these reports out sooner this year, and of the fact that if they fail to do so, there are some rather potentially nasty penalties for failing to get these things out. Well, this is our last broadcast before we get to the Christmas holiday. So next week when I talk to you, we will be coming after the Christmas holidays. And I'm sure some of you will not be listening next week because you're going to be gone through those periods. So I want to make sure and take the chance here to wish you all happy holidays here coming up, even if you discover, kind of like our grouchy cat on the screen that you may see here, if you're watching the video side of this, you're aware that there's going to be tax season right after this, which is sometimes somewhat depressing to think about as you're looking there as the new year comes in. But nevertheless, go out, enjoy yourself, have a good time, and take care. And hopefully we'll be talking to you when you get back after your break. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments here for the week of December 19th, 2016. Make sure you catch our regular updates on the website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Also, as I noted, you can download a PDF with all of our articles for today's topics from the updates, the weekly updates page on the website. If you have any questions, you can send them to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. Or you can find me there at edzollers. So until next week, go ahead, have an enjoyable Christmas holiday, and join us next week as we'll talk about additional developments here in the area of federal taxes.